This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. Let me begin by asking this. You grew up as a military brat. All over the United States, you have degrees in journalism, French, and psychology. How did you end up becoming a nature writer?
Well, I always felt very close to animals. And really, when you think of it, most of life on Earth isn't humans. And I had no brothers or sisters. Growing up on an army base, I didn't go to school on base, and I also didn't have friends in the neighborhood. But I didn't have human friends. I had plenty of other friends. They were bees and our Scottish Terrier, Molly, and our parakeet, Jerry, and a succession of lizards. And I got to know them, and I always felt like they had so much to teach us. I always wondered, just like you would with any other friend, what's it like to be you? And so this was why I wanted to become a writer. I wanted to find out, what's it like to be you? And to share it with all the other people who I reckoned might wonder the same thing.
Thank you. You've been talking about the intelligence and sensitivity of the octopus and how they can taste and feel with their suckers. Do you know if they're able to sense a person's mood or feelings as well? Pick up on their vibe, so to speak?
Well, that's an excellent question. And this, to my knowledge, has not been tested in a laboratory. But I would not be one bit surprised if they are not tasting just the surface of our skin, but the blood beneath it. And the blood beneath our skin is carrying all kinds of information about our mood. You know, all of those hormones and neurotransmitters, they're coursing through our bodies all the time. And if you've ever had a dog or a cat or dealt with wild animals, you know that they're picking up cues all the time that we miss. You know, scent, they're looking at. We're very visual animals, but we miss a lot of details of posture. And octopuses have these senses that we've never developed. So I would not at all be surprised, and I think that would be a really neat subject of research.
When people know how intelligent and sensitive an octopus is and still want to eat them because they're delicious, what do you say or do?
Well, one of my closest friends and dearest family members was a 750-pound pig named Christopher Hogwood. And people eat pork all the time. I mean, many folks probably had bacon for breakfast. And also, remember, you know, cannibalism is common in human cultures. We're supposed to taste, in fact, much like pigs, I am told. And cannibalism is still going on with humans as well as other animals. And by the way, pigs also, I discovered to my horror, do eat pork and enjoy it. So... But what I would say about this, a lot of people have told me that after reading my book, they can't eat octopus anymore, and that's fine with me. But if you really love octopus, if you want to save octopus, we need to care about the sea. And the sea is taking a huge hit from climate change. And so if you care about life on this planet and life in the sea, if you want to help octopuses, we have got to address this disaster that is happening, because it is profoundly affecting everybody who lives in the sea as well as everybody on land. So I'd love it if people didn't eat octopuses. There are so many other delicious things to eat. But an even more important thing to do with your love and your care for these animals is to protect the ocean.
Octopus-to-octopus communication. What did you see about individuals communicating?
Oh, another excellent question, which is under a lot of investigation. Octopuses are generally thought to be solitary animals, which makes you wonder, like, well, why do they want to play with us if they don't play with each other? Well, it's because they like to play, and they like to play with toys, and maybe we are just a fun toy for them. But we are discovering that octopuses do communicate with each other, and they do so chemically, and they do so with color changes. There's, as I mentioned, over 250 different species of octopus, and each one has a, probably different communication system, but there's a place in Australia where octopuses live close to one another. These are species called the gloomy octopus, although they probably are quite cheerful, but they have large eyes and they look gloomy. And this place is called Octopolis, because it's such a metropolis for octopuses. And if you want to see some cool octopus-to-octopus communication, go to either giantcuttlefish.com or just Google videos for Octopolis, and you will see octopuses, and you can tell what they're communicating sometimes. When an octopus wants another octopus to go away, in this place, the octopus rises up and assumes the shape of Darth Vader's helmet and turns black. And the other octopus shrinks away like Casper, the friendly ghost, and turns white. And even we know what's going on with that.
How do you feel about taking wild octopuses from their home in the wild so that humans can observe them in an aquarium?
That is another excellent and moral question. And what I'm looking at is the chances of what happens to you if you're an octopus. If you are an octopus, you are one of 100,000 baby octopuses that hatch one day. All but two of those octopuses will be torn limb from limb and eaten alive before they can lay eggs and or mate with another octopus. So the absolute best thing that you could ever hope for is that you are going to be that one or two out of 100,000 octopuses that gets to live long enough to lay your eggs and watch them hatch and then die, probably by being eaten alive at the end of your life. The second best thing that can happen to you is to be captured by someone who's going to let you live in an aquarium where you're going to have an interesting life, where you're going to be fed, where nobody will kill you. But most octopuses die a really gruesome death. However, you know, it's a gruesome death, but they are feeding somebody else. We take very few octopuses out of the ocean to show them to visitors at aquariums. There is a large fishery, however, for octopuses, both to be eaten by humans, some of whom are thrown into hot oil and fried alive, some of whom are cut up alive and used as bait because their arms will continue to twitch for a long time. So when you look at what probably is going to get most octopus and you look at the idea of living in an aquarium where hopefully, you know, the octopus is going to have an interesting life, you want to be the octopus who's living that interesting life. And it is something that I thought about very much. There are animals living in captivity, many of them who don't have an interesting life. Boredom is the worst thing that can happen to you, but other bad things can happen to you. But I'm really glad to know that there is an octopus enrichment manual and that people are aware that these are intelligent creatures that need to do something to keep their minds occupied.
Speaking of interesting lives, you've already had quite an interesting life, but this questioner wants to know how your writing life has changed since Soul of the Octopus has been on the shortlist for the National Book Award.
Oh, gosh, thank you for noticing that. Unless it was, like, from my best friends who were sitting in the audience. Anyway, it's been great, but it's harder to get time to write, and I'm doing a lot more writing right now of different books. I've been to Africa twice this spring, once with Dr. Richard Estes, the world's top expert on wildebeest, who's with us this morning. I'm working on a book on hyenas. I'm working on the book on the wildebeest. I just finished a little kid's book on Inky, the octopus who escaped from that New Zealand aquarium you may have heard of. He was caught right outside the aquarium's doors and by accident in a lobster pot, and he got out one day when his lid was ajar and slid down the drain and went home. And I've got another book I'm working on. Anyway, I've got a lot of books going on. So life is really good, and it's so wonderful to have you know, your work acknowledged like that, it's fabulous. But even better than having your work acknowledged is it was great to have that book, a natural history book, be a finalist for this National Book Award. Natural history books don't often get an honor like that. And so I felt that was a victory for octopuses and for marine life and for all the other species and all the other writers who've been writing for years about those other minds out there who matter.
And this is our final question. What's your next project?
Well, it's to write all these other books. And after I finish that, I've actually got a book that I'm going to be working on with Tia Strombeck, who's with us in the back row. She's going to be the photographer, and we're working on condors. You may notice that I like to write about animals that aren't always beloved by everyone. Hyenas, for example. Octopuses, who people considered monsters. And even though they're very charismatic, wildebeests don't get the credit they deserve. My husband, Howard Mansfield, likes to kid Dick and call them the styrofoam packing of the universe, because there are so many of them. But all of my work is aimed at the same thing, to say, look at this. This is great. And I hope I live a long time and get to write a lot more books, and you all are making that possible. Thank you so much.
Thank you again, Sai, for sharing your time and expertise with us today. You've been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org.